بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Salam, hello, peace to you all, and welcome to a very special edition of the program. I'm Adnan Hussein, historian of the medieval Mediterranean and Islamicate world, back with a very important conversation and a wonderful opportunity for us to learn more about what's happening in Iran from somebody who is there in Tehran right now. I'm really delighted to be able to welcome, I think for the first time, to the program, Dr. Helya Duttari, who is a legal scholar and currently postdoctoral fellow and researcher at University of Tehran. Helya, salam. It's so great to see you.
Salam, Adnan. Thank you very much for having me. I've been a fan for a very long time. So I'm really, I was really looking forward to this conversation, and I'm really grateful for having me.
Well, we're very grateful for you taking the time under, of course, very difficult circumstances. Iran is at war. The Ramadan war has entered its second month. So I don't know if we should still call it. I mean, we'll call it the Ramadan war because that's when it began and that gave it a lot of its important character, which I think we will, you know, also want to talk about. But it is entering its second month. And we're very grateful that you have been providing, when you can, various updates, interviews with people, and also sharing your thoughts and reflections on social media and on other programs. And so I just wanted to ask, you know, what are conditions like now at the beginning of the second month of this war? I know that it's still part of the Nowruz holiday period, so a lot of people are outside of Tehran, and there was preceding, right around the same time was, of course, the Eid festival. And so there were a lot of reasons for people to go back to their home villages or other parts of the country. I know many people went and visited Mashhad during this time. Friend and colleague, former student, Milad Dokhanji, I was so glad to hear from him, sent me a communication from Mashhad where he was visiting Imam Reza's tomb. So people are outside of the city and taking the opportunity, you know, for these celebrations, which itself is already amazing that amidst war, people can still find something to celebrate and spend time with their families and do this in a different way. But I think people would love to know more about how this experience has been right now. So what can you tell us about the situation on the streets and under the bombardment?
As you said, we're approaching the end of Nowruz holiday, and all of it, you know, from the very beginning of war, I would say it's been life affirming. People have been practicing life, have been insisting on continuing, you know, and there has been different forms of resilience. Some, as you mentioned, they're traveling across the country, I know people who stayed here, despite the fact that they travel every Nowruz, they wanted to make sure that Tehran also remains alive and remains lively during the holiday and it's not empty. And so I know beyond the essential shops, the bakeries, the essential needs, we have flower shops that in different neighborhoods are open and remain open. And we have people who are volunteering to wash rugs. I know collectives that are washing rugs for people, both for Nowruz holiday, because we have this tradition where, we do a deep clean of our homes right before Nowruz. And some people did not have the opportunity to do so because of the war, and they are choosing to do that. And also the ones that are helping people wash their logs or clean, they've also been helping those families who have been impacted. Their homes have been targeted or they've been impacted in another way. So they're helping for them to, I guess, find whatever remains of their house and clean it and make it of use again. You know, others remain in the streets. I was every time, I'm close to University of Tehran, every time, and I usually like come here to do interviews, and every time that I want to leave, especially at night, I'm stuck in like heavy traffic to get back home because of the rallies that take place on a daily basis here. And it hasn't changed for the past over a month now. And it's incredibly impressive. You know, I personally, I may feel a little bit drained at this point, you know, feeling a little bit tired, you know, in the evenings if I want to go out and participate, and I try my best to do it. But it's just incredible to see that people remain as steadfast as we enter the second month. There has been a lot of that, affirming life, keeping on going. And it's been, these moments offer really emotional relief and a sense of continuity with normal culture life, even, you know, under bombardment. But beyond that, we've been seeing militarily as well. We've been seeing the intensity of the attacks on infrastructures, on universities, and on still like civilian objects. The U.S. Zionist forces continue to target civilian objects and infrastructures. And last night, I barely got any sleep. I got my coffee as I was here on my way here. I kept waking up to bombs. It was hard. It was nearly impossible to get any sleep. So it's been intensifying for the past few days, for sure. People seem more ready to come back because towards the end of holidays, we're going to see a busier Tehran, I believe. So people are returning to Tehran. And those who have experienced living during the 8-year Western-backed aggression in the Iraq-Iran war, I think they are recollecting those memories. Are starting to, I guess, pass that on to the new generation as well, in case this is going to be a longer war, because they know how to do it. They know how to live under war, under aggression for a longer period of time. And I think this is the phase that we're going to be entering once the new year holiday is over, Nowruz holiday is over, and people start getting back. Because financially too, you know, there's been a lot of restrain on people who have businesses, on people who you know, depend on like their daily earnings to be able to pay their bills at the end of the month. And we're at the, you know, starting the second month, people need to go back to their businesses, people need to get back to their economy, needs to like wake up a little after the holiday. So I think we're going to see busier Tehran and busier cities and busier life.
Yes. Well, one thing you said that just reminded me when I was briefly in Tehran in December before the start of the economic protests as a result of the currency devaluation and manipulation by U.S. Treasury and so forth. But one thing, when you were describing the beautiful traditions of like spring cleaning before Nowruz and the flower shops, is how much and how important beauty is in Persian culture. Like the city, I mean, Tehran is not architecturally a gorgeous city. It's a more recent modern one. It's not like Isfahan, which I hope to visit, but I've seen pictures where you have a lot of traditional and monumental Islamic architecture. It's a newer, more modern city, but still, like along the streets, every kind of blank wall that you find on the street, somebody has painted a beautiful mural. Sometimes these are political themes. Other times it's just a field of flowers. And so that's something that I think would be nice for people to recognize and understand, that there's this real kind of commitment and love of beauty and beautiful things and making the place look beautiful. And so to keep that up, even amidst war and rubble and these attacks, is also a testament to the spirit of the people. But you mentioned the attack on civilian infrastructure, and this is something that, of course, we've seen so much of in the recent Gaza genocide, the devastations in, you know, Beirut during the, you know, war on Lebanon that has, you know, restarted more directly, but had been going on in its own way for 15 months, where civilian infrastructure, you know, has been attacked in various ways. But especially, you mentioned the university. This war started with an attack on a school for girls, with 168 school-age girls being, you know, massacred and murdered. So perhaps it shouldn't be so surprising that now they've also started attacking universities. But maybe you could tell us a little bit about the significance of this recent attack on, you know, a research, university research facility for science and technology that happened recently and that you've reported on.
Just a point of clarification on Minab as well. I know it was initially widely reported that it was only girls. It wasn't the 100 over 168 students between the age of 6 and 12 that were killed were both boys and girls, the elementary school. And I might be traveling soon to the south this week, and hopefully we can have another conversation once I go there and visit, and we'll see if I can talk to families. It's very hard also, from, you know, my experience, it's been very hard to talk to grieving families. It's just a really heavy thing to do for either parties, really. But anyway, the university I visited the same day that it was attacked. I was able to go visit the university. It was, and I've written this elsewhere, honestly, it's been really devastating for me as an academic to, as I was walking and I was seeing the hallways of the university, I spent a lot of many years at Carleton University, for instance, and a lot of hallways, a lot of classrooms would remind me of my days as a student in there. And just the thought of having my academic home destroyed as I was walking through it and talking to students, it was devastating. I saw the offices of professors who still had their suits. We always have like an extra suit in your office just in case you need it. I saw those that were still there. I saw shattered libraries and assignments of a student was just laid at one of the desks of the professors. The list of attendance was also like half burned on a paper. But what was really incredible when I was talking to both faculty members and students, for me, and it is still, you know, 1 month later, it hasn't for me lost its, how special it is. And it is their resolve. I don't see defeat. I don't see hopelessness. They were determined to, you know, the research facility that was bombed. And it was also the Department of Physics. It was the Ma'arif department, which provides, you know, social sciences prerequisite courses. And it was their like mini version of like uni center that was also impacted, where they held their exams, where they held the auditorium, their socials. But the research center that was also one of the main targets was home for production of civilian satellites in Iran, including Omid satellite and Zafar satellite. This is not to say that those were destroyed or destructed, but I'm just saying the university is a place where these research and developments were taking place. And these satellites provide important industrial development to Iran in the sense that they do mapping, they help with agriculture research, And that's the target. That is the pattern of sanctions, assassinations, military attacks, covert operations. It's a clear pattern of the development of and the deindustrialization of the country, precisely because it is the indigenous homegrown defense industries and beyond that has been helping Iran, that has been key to Iran's assertion of sovereignty and defending itself and supporting, providing material support to anti-colonial regional movements in the region. So, and when I talk to faculties, I asked, and maybe this report will be coming out, I asked one of the faculties, what is your message to your colleagues in the West? And he said, at this point, we're just going to ask them to for themselves to judge them. We're not going to judge them. We're not going to tell them anything. We want them to hold themselves accountable and see which side of history they stand on. So be the judge of yourself, he said. And another faculty told me that the research center that was the effort of 20 years of research and efforts of the university members and community members of the university, he was certain and he was confident that it was going to be rebuilt in less than 2 years with more advanced technology. And he said, you know, when they targeted the nuclear scientist a few years ago, when there was a round of assassination of nuclear scientists, there were many young Iranians who signed up to study nuclear science. They wanted to volunteer to go to that field. And he was certain that we're going to see another round of students who are going to sign up to advance the anything that is being targeted in a STEM field. And my talks with the students also affirmed this and their determination to do so.
Yeah, that's a remarkable boomerang effect of the, you know, violent attacks by empire. They don't seem to understand that this, in fact, actually just increases the resolve. I remember hearing about the great popularity of nuclear physics and nuclear engineering as fields after these attacks, and also the history of sanctions upon, you know, Iran's nuclear program, its civilian peaceful nuclear program. There was a very good documentary by Ali Alizadeh on Jedal English about Iran's nuclear program on his channel. And they did talk about the popularity of it once it became, you know, politicized and a target of U.S. Sanctions. So we can hope and expect that the very educated students who have already demonstrated, you know, the young engineers, both men and women, and this is something that also should be emphasized to the audience, of like the greater percentage of STEM students and engineers and people receiving PhDs in science, technology, engineering, math are women. So many of these military technologies that have been astonishing the world, you know, well, principally the West, that had these ideas that Iran didn't have any serious capabilities after 47 years of sanctions and pressure. It's actually many of them have been designed, developed, and built by women. So that's something that we definitely expect and hope to see. But one thing I wanted to ask about further, I know you'll have a report on this, but you did post something around the Western academics' complicity in their own, both complicity in their own, what we could call state system, you know, where the universities and the knowledge sector are actually contributing to you know, Western empire, but also their shocking lack of solidarity. You know, this is hard for people, you know, in the academy to hear, many of whom who think of themselves as very liberal, very conscious, and have been in favor of you know, many of them, some of them have been, you know, in favor of solidarity with Palestine in a way, but haven't really taken full responsibility for what they can do. That I think you posted something about how it's 2.5 years and many academics still debating whether they should do BDS for Gaza. I mean, we saw Scholasticide in Gaza. So it's no wonder that if we become allowed the Gaza paradigm and model to become normalized, that, you know, when it's happened now to Iran's educational institutions and research facilities, that there's almost no discussion of this. It's not considered even an issue for so many people. So I'm a little concerned actually about this person, you know, the person you interviewed from the faculty saying, oh, we should leave it to, we just leave it to their conscience. I mean, of course, it's frustrating to keep showing and saying, but I don't have a lot of hope that there's the self-examination, you know. But so this is a big problem or a big question. You're somebody who's been educated in, you know, universities in Canada. How would you kind of like speak to people about, you know, the real fundamental issues that if you are an educator, you know, what should you know and understand about silence in the face of attacks on Iran's higher education, as well as, of course, if you want to connect it to the Scholasticide we've already witnessed in Gaza?
You know, there are a few points I want to highlight here. First is as you correctly mentioned, you know, the fact that this was allowed with impunity, targeting mass murdering children, targeting hospitals, targeting universities. The fact that this was allowed in Gaza is the mere reason, with impunity, is the mere reason we're seeing it continue in Iran. And I will assure you that if we don't stop it in Iran, it will continue to, beyond Iran's borders. It will continue in Pakistan. It will continue in China. It will continue in Russia. It will continue beyond our borders. So, and that, and it means, you know, and it means that it's going to impact those who reside in the imperial court as well, as we're seeing Iran inflicting the cost upon them. I think part of the fascism that I was targeted during that time of fascism, that they were vicious repression and silencing and repression in universities. I think that is the extension of what they're doing outside, and it's completely interconnected. As an academic, if you're okay with universities outside of your border being bombed, if you're okay with, or silenced, not even okay, if you find yourself silent in the face of targeting education facilities, assassination of scientists in the global north, in the global south, the fascism is gonna come back to you, and we saw it, and we saw the fascism in United States and Canada on this. And is this the type of world we want to be living in? You know, is allowing and having kids killed, is this the kind of is this supposed to be normalized? Like, are we supposed to just accept a world in which schools are targeted, universities are targeted, scientists are assassinated? And so I think that's one part of it. I think there is a moral responsibility, and there is also, I say this, and it's not necessarily, you know, I'm bitter because of my experience in the West. I think Western subjects are below the conditions of sacrifice, as Ali Kadri puts it. I think at this point, in this moment of history, it is important to be willing to pay costs for the liberation that we're fighting for collectively. And yes, there's going to be repression. Yes, there's going to be loss of jobs. And many of us have been affected by this. And it's it's the choice that you have to make in this historical moment, where you stand and on which side of history do you stand. Is your job more important than the lives of others, you know, in the periphery? And I continue to be deeply disappointed by labor in the West and labor movements in the West. I love what Ali Kadri, how Ali Kadri contextualizes, explains this by saying, it's no longer about the 8 hours work. It's about the fact that the 8 hours work of a worker in London does not mean shorter life of workers in Iraq. And I think that's what we're seeing happen. I think labor is complicit. I think academia is complicit. I think movements who have been, you know, doing educations for over 2.5 years now, okay, education is very important. Doing the agitation and doing all of it is very important. When are we going to use that education and what are we going to do with it? If not after 2.5 years of a regional war at this point waged by their governments. I think there needs to be accountability and self-reflection, a very serious one. And I have many comrades, many principled comrades, many strong and people I look up to and mentors that I learn from who reside in the belly of the beast. And I continue to be inspired by them, how courageous they are, because it can be a scary to live under that type of fascism and a stand up for truth.
Yeah, we can hope that something may transform. It's been 2.5 years, but now we are, of course, as you're saying, a regional war that could have and will is already starting to have global consequences. So it is a time of decision, and where, you know, the barriers or the illusions, you know, that people may have that immunize them or separate them from the real conditions that are taking place in the world are evaporating and being torn apart as we see reality in a very direct way. And so that is forcing a decision time. You know, people have to make their commitments and recognize and understand that there's no way to insulate themselves from the consequences of this imperialist system as it, you know, continues to move towards greater erratic, violent lashing out in the course of its weakening and decline. So this is we should actually be thinking of it more, it seems to me, as a time of opportunity, because this is the moment to actually win a better future for everyone, right? Because there is the possibility that empire can be defeated because of the heroic efforts of the people of Gaza, the people of South Lebanon, the people in Iraq, the people in Yemen, and right now, principally, you would say, the people of Iran. And so I wanted to talk a little bit more about how people have been responding to this situation of attack and imperial war upon them. You've mentioned already and have talked about it in other interviews about this remarkable phenomenon of defiance, of people coming into the streets. You put it, I think, extremely well, and something that I've been mentioning also is that these are people find it in the West, it's like preposterous, like it doesn't make sense. There's bombardment taking place. It's a war. Shouldn't you be finding a safe place, you know, avoiding public spaces, just spending time in, you know, your home, and if you can, a shelter, or get out of the cities into some village, you know, but it doesn't make sense by a kind of typical individualist logic of my personal security. And so it's very hard to recognize and understand what is the meaning of this phenomenon and why would people be so kind of defiant and show their defiance in a particular way like that publicly. You know, Trump called, Netanyahu, they called for people to come out into the streets, right? Meaning take down the so-called regime, you know, overthrow your government, take these institutions. They did that several times during the period of the protests. And they also put out that message at the start of this war, hoping that these assassinations of leaders, including the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, and that they expected that people should come out into the streets and overturn, you know, the government. And you've made the point that, you know, I hope you can talk a little bit more again about it, that, you know, when that didn't work, they started trying to still create those conditions by targeting not just the hospitals and the ambulances that we've seen, you know, so many hospitals and ambulances and medical facilities destroyed and bombarded, but also the whole architecture of public order and security, the police stations, you mentioned government offices, judicial, you know, offices, all the things that would create chaos so that there would be an opportunity, you know, for people to come out in opposition have a kind of regime change, so-called regime change operation. That hasn't happened, and that frustration has led to even more attacks on civilian, you know, civilians and schools, universities, like we were just speaking about. You have been doing some incredible interviews with people during these nightly demonstrations. So, you know, how have the people responded? I'd really love to talk and investigate this more fully for our audience that may not understand the unique logic of Iranian people's response to this situation by being so defiant.
So part of it, a significant part of it, I would argue, is rooted, as you mentioned, in the Shia culture. You know, Iranians have historically honored Ashura and Muharram and Karbala, and they live it yearly. You know, they live the legacy and the story of Karbala and how Imam Hussein and his entire family showed up, to knowing that they may very well be defeated, like being aware of how the odds were against them. And nonetheless, they believed for the truth of the word. They will stand up and they will give their lives to that cause, for that liberation, against oppression, to fight oppression and to refuse to be subjugated to the tyranny of their time. And so this is a principle. This is a very fundamental principle of Shiism, where Hayhat Man Nazala, right? You would be better in translating that for me. But our dignity is worth more than our lives, essentially. And so part of it is that. And I think I've been saying this to friends, that what distinguishes those who are able to protect Iran versus the forces the imperial forces and their agents, is the fact that the revolutionary subjects in Iran are actually willing to die for what they believe in. And you can't say the same about the forces that are paid or you know, are the agents of the empire. And the concept of martyrdom in Shiism is not, despite popular belief, is not about dying. It's quite the opposite. It's about how you choose to live, how you choose to dedicate and spend your life. It's about life. It's not about death. And so I think this has been very present and very pronounced in the spirit of resistance and resilience and defiance that we're seeing. And that's number one. And I think the martyrdom, as much as they think targeting the leaders and the supreme leader himself and the commanders and other political figures of Iran, as much as the United States believes that it's going to weaken Iran, it really has shifted or at least inflicted moments of reflection for many young Iranians who did not necessarily like or sympathize with many of these leaders. You know, it's forcing them to challenge their own assumptions. And it's giving them that opportunity of like clarifying moments. So That's part of it. Others is also, I've seen non-religious people who are not necessarily, who don't confer, who don't practice, masalan, Islam, who are extremely nationalist. And I think it's been very interesting to see, you know, as some attend, you know, daily, like evening rallies with religious songs or you know, it's a different atmosphere. And others go to cultural centers and read Shahnameh, read Hafez poetry or Shahnameh poetry, which has a stories of heroes of Iran historically that fight, you know, forces of death and destruction. And they recall that and they try to position themselves and be rooted in the history of in the history and culture of Iranian poetry and Iranian civilization. The two are not necessarily, I don't think the two are contradictory or exclusive of one another at all. Sayyid Ali Khamenei was very well versed in Shahnameh, in fact, and extensive Iran's poetry. But I think people are finding different ways and different from different walks of life with different levels of faith and practice of Islam. They are finding themselves one common principle and foundation to stand on, and that is Iran, that is protecting the sovereignty of Iran. And I don't think anything could unite the country after the attempted coup that took place in January, which did really make the society fragile in a sense that there was fragmentation. I had discussions with my aunties. I had discussions in my classes, in my communities, that who were rightly so, and we can talk about, I don't think right now is the right time to talk about internal contradictions of Iran, but we had a lot of very serious and very heated conversations and debates within family, within different circles of people debating that. And that was very pronounced. But they underestimated the people's love for their country and for their sovereignty, despite all the legitimate grievances, despite all the fractions and I guess divisions that has been imposed upon the country with years of sanctions and covert hybrid warfare in the form of covert and overt operations, propaganda, media. Iran has united the people.
Yeah, that's certainly how it feels. I know, of course, there may be always a hardcore, a very dissident people. They're probably very quiet now in these circumstances. But, you know, one thing that this kind of public outpouring of taking the streets and the public space for these rallies nightly to show their defiance against the imperialist war and their support for their nation, their country, their people, you know, their government that is mounting defense on their behalf. One thing that it seems like it has done is that it has prevented, in a way, any opportunity for agents of, you know, regime change type operations. You know, we saw the chaos on the streets produced by some of these, you know, people, you know, shooting and killing, police and, you know, Basij, you know, volunteers, people who are responsible for kind of public order and so forth and so on, and doing exactly what the U.S.-Israeli bombardment and attacks are doing, which is, you know, attacking police stations, banks, hospitals, clinics, ambulances, fire trucks, all those kinds of things, that same destruction that horrified people. You know, when they saw it and turned people against these groups trying to destabilize all of society to change the, you know, Islamic Republic of Iran from through this kind of violent chaos, that what's happening now, there's a continuity that has made that illegitimate, basically. And people have taken the streets themselves, so that prevents any of these attempts. Everybody's already who is supporting. And so that seems to be a wonderful, kind of an amazing kind of social tactic. And also, it seems that it has produced stability and order from the people, you know, and it has shown that even without top leadership, the society itself can find its own ways to make sure that people get what they need. There's no, from what I understand, you know, runs upon the grocery stores to just take everything for oneself, to hoard. There's no like, you know, disorder on the streets. There are volunteer groups. There are people working collectively to support one another, clean up after a bombardment. You know, that's a resilient society, you know, that is deeper even than just when you think these institutions have been taken away. That is very kind of interesting and remarkable, worth remarking on, because it would be so different in other social contexts. So maybe this worth, you know, if you have any response and discussion of that, it would be interesting to hear.
I thank you for that. That was beautifully put. And I want to build upon what you said in terms of these people being in the streets is protecting the revolution. Or it being hijacked. And I think, you know, both people and the state learned from, especially the events of the past year. What I want to add is at this point, there is very minimal risk of, you know, any regime change for internally, at least right now. So it's, the states have been secured. And yet we continue to see people on the street. And I think right now, then, this is more than protecting the country from chaos. This is also the rallies. What I think, how I understand them is moving beyond that, moving beyond protecting the revolution itself, but also about how we end the war with dignity. Mm-hmm. It's about how we're gonna conclude this phase of our struggle towards the broader decolonization and liberation of the region. And I think many are in the streets. This is something that the state has to, you know, grapple with, that mm-hmm. if we are to accept conditions of, you know, conditions that they need to be, then conditions that are not, I guess, favorable to many revolutionaries who have been on the streets and have been demanding the avenge of Ayatollah Khamenei, the avenge of the martyrs of our kids, our martyrs and our people. I think it's also a pressure on the government and on the decision makers on how to conclude this phase of the war, and how be accountable and responsive to people who are the core and the center of this revolution. And they will have to think about that. It can be a difficult situation to be in, especially if we have, you know, reformist segments within the government who might be pushing to, you know, come to some form of concession or agreement or peace or ceasefire. It's bigger than that. I think the state right now is accountable and needs to be responsive to the demands of these people in the streets who continue to hold it down.
Yeah, that's an excellent and very important point, is that this revolutionary spirit, you know, this is almost like the second phase of the revolution, you know, like it's a revitalizing of the revolutionary spirit, and it is making demands. The leadership, you know, one reason why the assassinations also inspired this kind of a response is that you could see that, you know, the leaders were with the people, they're suffering and they're sacrificing and willing to make a sacrifice for on behalf of the people. The way it goes now is, I think, very interesting, as you're saying, is that that has charged the popular sovereign kind of revolutionary will of the people. The leaders cannot abandon or betray this kind of spirit right now, you know, like they can't make some backroom deal. And we can see that this is emboldening. This is a people's war. you know, for sovereignty. It's being waged as a people's war. The leadership has to be, you know, reflective of that political will. And that's, we see that they're rejecting negotiations until it is the right time and the conditions are being met. That agenda is being set not just by government leaders, but as you're saying, by people, what they're chanting, what they're demanding. And it could have very consequential outcomes for the entire region, as you're pointing out, the decolonizing component. So this may be in some ways, originally in 1978, 79, you know, Imam Khomeini did not think of the revolution as just a nationalist revolution to free Iran. It was, of course, principally, that's the first kind of goal and outcome, was to get rid of the taghut, the oppression and tyranny of the Shah, and restore popular sovereignty to the people of Iran. But he has had greater ambitions of also, you know, freeing the whole region, that they should also be inspired by the revolutionary ideals to decolonize West Asia, to defeat U.S. empire, to, you know, solve the question of Palestine, right, from the settler colonial Zionist entity. So in some ways, this is an opportunity. And it's very interesting to hear how important the people setting of the political agenda is in this moment. I mean, what's more democratic? Like, we keep hearing about how this is a, you know, irrational, dangerous theocracy, you know, but in point of fact, it is more responsive to the will of the people because of revolutionary activity. So, you know, there's a lot maybe to work with there, but also maybe you might also want to touch upon how Palestine has figured so prominently, not even just in Al-Quds Day when it was highlighted, but in all of the statements, and if whether that's also part of the kind of these rallies and what people are chanting and what they're demanding as well.
It is seen as one united battle all across. We Iranians understand this, at least those who are political subjects on the streets and fighting. They understand this as our struggles as interconnected. Historically, our region has been subject to colonial and Zionist occupation, and it is only through the collective struggle for liberation that we're gonna be liberated. You know, it's our shared destiny in this region, and those of us who are indigenous to these lands share this struggle and share this fate together. So this is very well established. The point I wanted to make about the two points I've been noticing a lot, and that is in every rally I go in, every, you know, community, the working class really do represent a lot of, they represent a lot of what we're seeing. Like, the working class are the ones, not that it's not necessarily that it's exclusive to working class, but they've been, the workers have been the sovereign of the country. It is, as you said, you know, the people are the sovereign, the workers are the sovereign. And I've been seeing how those who really are in dire financial conditions and circumstances, they've been generous with their times, with how they're dedicating their life to keeping their community safe. I know bakeries that are baking breads for free in a neighborhood that is, you know, it's a working class neighborhood and it's been hit. And so the baker has decided to provide free bread for the community. And it's just been incredible to see how the popular revolution, as we understand the 79 revolution, really heavily relies on its working class and on the workers as its sovereigns to protect the country. And this is something I will continue to talk about as I will be visiting the South as well, talking to labor movement and their leaders. But I wanted to mention that because I think for myself, it's been really inspiring to see it. And this is, and I should add, this is against, you know, over five decades of sanctions that have been targeting the working class disproportionately against every other sector of society. They are the primary targets of both the war and sanctions. And I've been, this is a part of my research where I argue that sanctions are in fact a class, transnational class warfare. Iran, as you know, no country, including Iran, like, and it, this doesn't exclude Iran, no country faces sanctions as a whole. You know, there is a spectrum based on class and based on social status, how people are impacted and receive sanctions, from beneficiaries to victims, and sometimes the two are can be blurry. But the working class are the primary target, consistently have been the primary target of sanctions regimes. And it's incredible to see how the working class, who have been paying the price for this hybrid warfare for many years, are the ones who are determined and have such political clarity and principle to protect the revolution, because they understand that struggle and what it is that they're fighting for depends on the sovereignty, and the sovereignty is the precondition for advancing their betterment of conditions of life and their struggles.
Yeah, this is such important and relevant analysis, it seems to me, because, of course, what a lot of people don't understand, perhaps, about the era of maximum pressure sanctions and its consequences and effects on Iran, and just as sanctions have done elsewhere, is that it produces kind of corrupt neoliberal kind of classes. It harms the people, the working class people, but the elites find, with their kind of close connection to the state, ways of still profiting out of the sanctions regime, and they are less affected, you know, by it. And we know, of course, that there have been different political kind of orientations and groupings, you know, within the Islamic Republic. They have elections, they have different governments with different orientations and policies, and there are the reformists who often have adopted a kind of neoliberal kind of set of assumptions about the economy, and that we need to move more in that kind of direction, away from the revolutionary social kind of solidaristic kinds of policies of the government, that this is maybe a transformative moment in some ways, what you were talking about, the working class kind of confidence and response in not only defense of their system and their sovereignty, but making demands on it that maybe in the post-revolutionary, I mean, phase after the war, after the Ramadan war, that they will be demanding that for their sacrifice, for their commitment, that they deserve, you know, to have social programs and an economy that is more fair and equitable and so on. Because if, as this war seems to be accomplishing, is the reversal of some of the sanctions. Already Iranian oil production is, like, the sanctions have been lifted because of the crisis of, you know, oil supply and, you know, fossil fuel supply, but also because of the Strait of Hormuz and the way that that's being, you know, kind of managed by a sovereign Iranian nation during this war, is that that will bring in income. The question is going to be, you know, how is that distributed? How is that, you know, supposed to be employed for sovereign development? That's going to be such an interesting question. And, you know, this maybe leads me to a question to ask you about, because sometimes there is this on the left, you know, in the imperial core or in elsewhere, you know, I think less so in the global south, but certainly in Western Marxism, Western left, this kind of construction of Iran and Iran's kind of state system and society and economy as not a socialist state. So, you know, like, okay, we might identify with the anti-imperialist component. We don't think there should be war on them, but, you know, we don't really feel that this is a, you know, what should our position be for support for a non-socialist state? Well, you know, maybe there's some way to think about socialism itself in a kind of more flexible and broader way. Everything that you were describing about the working class being in movement here, and what its kinds of demands are, suggests that if the Islamic Republic meets those demands, what's the difference between calling it a socialist state or not? Just because they have a religious language, they have their own constitution, and so on. So I'm wondering, you know, if maybe you have any reflections about that, which gets us back to, you know, some of this kind of language of Shi'i theology and so on, that it in fact actually embodies both anti-imperialism and a socialistic kind of spirit. I mean, what does it mean to be the nation of Imam Hussein? Social solidarity, sacrifice for one another, standing up against injustice. I mean, so what is socialism then if it's not that? So I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that for our what Gerald Horn calls our friends on the left.
So a few I guess immediate responses, and you know, being at war on a daily basis makes me a little bit more blunt these days. And my response is, Iran doesn't need to be a socialist for any left to take a principled stance on it. Iranians have the agency to determine to be anything that they want, to choose any political system to be governed and by and to build their societies as such. And so it is inherently Eurocentric. It is inherently problematic to impose any political system, including socialism, upon Iranians, as we've seen prove Iranians have proven to be incredibly more powerful of political agents than any Western subjects, because Iranians have shown that they're able to overthrow governments they don't like. And we can't say the same about Americans, for instance, right now. So it's important to, I guess, to start with that taking an anti-imperialist principled position on Iran needs to be unconditional right now, as Iran is facing the most vicious colonial forces and imperial forces of our time. That's number one. Number two, you know, Iran right now, the states, and trust me, I am the first critique of Iranian neoliberalism and how our economic policies over the past three decades, at least, has been in sharp contradiction to anti-imperial principles of the revolution, especially in its foreign policy. And I've written about this, and I think these are very important conversations that we are having internally, and I'll continue to have those in spaces in English language media after the war. But it also, I want to emphasize that ever since the war, first of all, Iran continues to have free healthcare, despite the fact that significant portion of healthcare has been privatized over the past 3 days due to neoliberal policies. But, you know, for everyone who has been impacted by of any level, who have been impacted by the war, the government has been providing free healthcare, and hospitals are obligated to treat any patients for free. Iran has been providing free educational programs because the schools have been stopped and students are not going to classrooms. And so the national TV is providing free education, bringing on teachers and dedicating every hour of the day for educational programs so that they don't get behind of their lessons, for instance. And I could go on about the type of, and they've been very, the government has been, and I'm a big critique of this government, don't get me wrong, but the government has been doing a great job in terms of stabilizing the prices over the past month. You know, we have not seen, despite what you would expect under war conditions, we have been seeing even some prices like meat and chicken and groceries either stay the same or in fact go lower than what it was. So the government is in fact providing and securing social welfare for the people, and is taking a good care of its people, as it's its job. You know, it's not a privilege; it's their job, and they're doing it. That's my message to the left. We are able to determine how we will govern, how we will hold our government accountable. Number one, what is the political system that we choose to have for our state, and also I think Iranians, and you know, I don't claim to be an expert on liberation theology and Shiism, but as much as I have been practicing this for my entire life. I think Islam and the discourse of Shia, social justice of Imam Ali in Shiism, for anyone who's interested, I strongly suggest that they look into it and they do their own readings and research, has a rich history. Shia provides a very rich history of social justice and how to implement that in a political system. Because Shia, the discourse of Shiism provides a system that's the whole principle of the Islamic Revolution. That we have, there is a famous line by Imam Khomeini that says, "Diyanatama in Siyanatamas," our religion is our politics, and our politics is our religion, indicating that Islam provides a solid political discourse for how societies need to be governed. And that is rooted principally on social justice and on the Mostazafin. Iran's revolution is, its message to the world was that this is the revolution of Mostazafin. This is the revolution of the oppressed. And which is why it relies on the Mostazafin and on the oppressed as its greatest assets and potential, as I've been saying. So, yeah, I think, I invite my friends in the left to open their horizon, to study Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, to listen to his speeches, to study Sayyid Ali Khamenei, to look into their thoughts and their teachings and what these revolutionary anti-colonial leaders of our times, what has been their discourse of thoughts and inspirations and faith that have led them to become the type of anti-colonial leaders, significant anti-colonial leaders of our time.
Yes, I mean, I think I will probably try to have some kind of like episode dedicated to looking more deeply at how Shi'i revolutionary theology developed with reinterpretation, because not a lot of people know, like, you know, for example, the Muharram, you know, the anniversary of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet and one of the kind of pious leaders of the community, and regarded as the third imam in Shi'i tradition, that is third religious and political guide and leader of the ummah, of the community. Those commemoration ceremonies, like in past history, they're called ta'ziyah, mourning and grieving. In the past, a lot of times it was very internal, right? It was this, self-blame and feeling, how could we have let this sacrifice happen? Woe is to us. You know, that has a very different political character. But what happened in Shi'i tradition is that the interpretation advanced to become, we should all be like Imam Hussein. Right? Is that we should stand up. He gave us the example that we're supposed to follow, not just that we grieve that he was sacrificed, but that this is something that all of us have to be willing to have that sacrifice as well, if we are truly to follow his tradition and his teaching. He's teaching us something. But that wasn't always how it was interpreted. But the revolutionary interpretations, now that is the dominant way of seeing. That's why we have, you know, in southern Lebanon and Ansar Allah, like all these different post-Iranian revolution kind of communities of Shi'is have adopted this as a kind of mainstream revolutionary interpretation of what the meaning of that is. That means, you know, that there's history, that there's resources within these histories, within these just cultures and systems for revolution. And there's also, you know, resources in them for reactionaries to use and so on. The question is what do we do now? We have a choice. We have a decision. What kind of faith, what are the values of our faith, right? And activate those. And I saw a wonderful kind of interview with an Iraqi man who was talking about his on some Iraqi program, a little clip that was circulated where he was talking about how he, you know, had traveled to Cairo, and at security in the airport, they kind of took him away for special, you know, kind of interrogation. And they asked him, okay, so are you Shi? And he said, brother, this is like old news. We're past the Shi Sunni. Like that, there's only two mazhabs now, two orientations, two schools of faith. One is Madhab al-Muqawama and Madhab al-Imbitah. You're either, you know, part of the school of resistance, or you're part of the school of subservience and prostration. Do you want to have dignity? Do you want to have human existence with value and dignity? It doesn't matter Shia, Sunni, Christian, atheist, you know. Choose your school. These are the two schools. And that's the time of decision. And the people of Iran are giving us inspiration, as well as in Lebanon, Yemen, you know, all over too. That's a lesson that we should be taking, you know, it seems to me.
That was beautifully said. Thanks for sharing that, Adnan. And I guess just to wrap this up, I've been hearing a lot with from my friends that they recall this, that every land is Karbala and every day is Ashura. And the struggle is really rooted in the fact that we see ourselves as the continuation of this long legacy of fighting for liberation as part of this humanity. And we are fighting for this humanity. And we are inheriting this struggle from our ancestors, from years and years. And inshallah, we'll live to see the victory for liberation of the humanity.
Inshallah, you know, Fatallah Qareeb, inshallah, yes. Well, I was going to ask you a couple other things about these annoying diasporic kind of confusers, but, you know, we ended on such a kind of wonderful and hopeful, which is the real message, that I don't even want to, like, you know, mess with that. I just want to thank you so much, Helia, for your time, for the work that you've been doing, for the outstanding example that you've been giving people of how to use their knowledge, you know, to reinforce the message of resistance against empire, and for all of the insights and information that you're able to share with my audience. I'm absolutely sure that it will be very much appreciated and very informative and thought-provoking for our audience. So I want to thank you so much for making the time. I know things are not easy over there for you to give us, to go to a facility where you could have proper internet and to be able to speak with us. It's so much appreciated. Jazakallah. Thank you.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much, dear Adnan, for everything that you're doing, the incredible work that you're doing, and my love and solidarity to you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Okay. Salam alaikum to you and to everyone else.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.